This is Christy Drutman, and you are listening to Brown Girl Green, where I interview environmental leaders and advocates about the importance of justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion, as well as creative solutions to the climate crisis. I'm working to change the image of what it means to be an environmentalist in the 21st century. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Brown Girl Green. We are in the winter months here on the East Coast, and your California girl is still super freezing. So I am locking myself indoors and making these podcast episodes. So that is good news for you because I'm bringing on some really interesting guests the next few weeks. And I'm really excited for the guest of today's episode, a friend and a mentor of mine, Daphne Rose Sanchez. She is an amazing community organizer born and raised in New York City, and she knows all the things around climate, housing, and how to address energy justice and energy insecurity, which we're going to be talking about in today's episode. So, have you heard the term energy insecurity? If you haven't, energy insecurity is the inability to adequately meet basic household energy needs. This has profound implications for health and health equity, especially in Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities. More than 30 million U.S. households are energy insecure, meaning that they are unable to adequately meet household energy needs for things like electricity, gas, or other power sources used for lighting, cooling, heating, and the use of household appliances and electronic devices. Why is this such a big issue, you may ask? Well, basically, you know, if a community is energy insecure, that means that there's already all these previous systemic barriers that are making them a vulnerable population, whether that means that they don't have access to adequate housing, or if they do have a power outage, they don't necessarily have the resources for a backup generator, or during a heat wave, they may not have all of the educational resources of knowing where to go to make sure that they don't get heat stroke. All of these may seem like small factors, but they really make a long-term difference in terms of the lifespan of people living in these communities, the long-term health and well-being of people that live in these areas that are energy insecure. And as we all know, I mean, those of you listening to this podcast, energy usage is so critical for our day-to-day lives, for just basic survival. And it is a basic human right that everyone deserves access to. But unfortunately, a lot of people, even here in the United States, do not. Over the past 5 years, between 2016 and 2020, the U.S. experienced natural disasters that cost over $606.9 billion in damages, and this led to longer and more frequent disruptions in power. This was according to data from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. It's becoming more clear that many longstanding programs to address energy insecurity are pretty outdated. A lot of them were created, you know, decades ago, and they don't really match up to the current needs and infrastructure and lives that people in a lot of cities and areas across America are experiencing today. And so a lot of these programs and policies to address energy insecurity need to be refreshed to address things like energy efficiency, energy equity, and switching over things like gas stoves to electric stoves, for instance, since we now know that gas stoves are not the best for your health either, even though I have a gas stove and I definitely need to switch it over as well. Someone can hit me up and help me out with that. That'd be great. The other end of the spectrum on this is people advocating for renewable energy, solar, wind, etc. You know, saying we need to get off fossil fuels. We need to transition as quickly as possible. Yes, that is absolutely true. But when we're doing that transition, are we really prioritizing the needs of communities of color or people who come from low-income backgrounds? Not always. Sometimes it's just a technology-first approach and community-second. But when you're trying to do implementation and you're trying to make things like solar and wind feasible and, you know, financially sustainable in the long term, you have to be able to address the demographic that you're serving. Otherwise, you may actually price out a community or displace them. And we're finding that resilient communities with energy efficient facilities and other distributed energy resources can reduce danger to public safety, security, and health. But many communities of color face unequal access to these kinds of resources, specifically energy generation and battery storage due to, you know, upcoming weather events, or even in New York City a couple years ago with Hurricane Sandy. These things could strike at any moment, and our community is going to be prepared. It remains to be seen. In a preliminary release of the 2020 Residential Energy Consumption Survey data, the Energy Information Administration reported that households with children, renters, and members of racial and ethnic minority groups, specifically Black and Latino households, reported more instances of energy insecurity than their counterparts who did not have any of these characteristics. And we're seeing that this goes even further for people's long-term health and well-being. In 2020, it was shown that nearly 25 million households reduced or went without food or medicine to be able to pay for their energy bills. This is just not right. It's like, what are these policymakers doing to be able to address energy as a human right? It seems that even though we have some of the most advanced technology in the world to give people energy sources, the communities that need it the most are the ones being priced out. What's up with that? So Daphne is going to really dive in this episode about how do we start talking about energy insecurity? How has her company been able to tackle that in a really meaningful way? And how can communities be able to start mobilizing around things as ridiculous as growing energy bills in the face of inflation, late-stage capitalism, and the collapsing of global ecosystems? You know, a small but mighty task that we really need to tackle. And so I'm really excited for you all to listen to Daphne speak and share her expertise. And I hope that you get a lot of gems out of this episode, as much as I did, as a fellow woman of color entrepreneur trying to put solutions out in the world. Daphne really nails it in the ground about how she built a business rooted in community, grounded in principle, and ultimately making scalable impact for the people that need it the most. So take a listen. Welcome to another episode of the Brown Girl Green podcast. I'm your host, Chrissy Drutman, otherwise known as Brown Girl Green, where I interview environmental leaders and advocates about the importance of justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion, as well as creative solutions to the climate crisis. I am very excited to be joined by a friend and a mentor of mine, and she is going to be telling us all the things about energy justice. So I would love if you could introduce yourself to our audience.
Sure. Hi, everyone. My name is Daphne Rose Sanchez. She, her pronouns. I'm the executive director of a firm called Kinetic Communities Consulting, or KC3 for short. We're an energy, equity, and housing firm here in New York City, and really excited to be here.
Fantastic, fantastic. Well, I'm so happy to have you here too, because if people, you know, if you're just listening to the podcast, but if you're also, you know, watching the videos, we are doing my first at-home in-person podcast studio setup. It's been a journey in the making. You know, I really want the podcast to feel more of like a community feel, getting people's voices directly in, you know, my own recording space. So excited to dive into this here today. So, you know, tell us more about KC3. What was the story behind that? What is your background? What has been driving the work that you do in the energy sector?
Sure. So I'm a native New Yorker. Like, I'm born and raised in New York. I'm going to probably die here. and for me, the work of energy and housing is very much rooted in my tradition and my culture. I was raised in public housing. My father was raised in public housing. My grandmother was raised in affordable housing. And so one thing that I had realized growing up is that there's this interesting connection of culture and the built environment. And so I started working in sustainability, really focused on how do I connect community to these sustainability initiatives, to environmental initiatives. And what I realized was that the way programs are designed and functioned were not necessarily catered to the people that I know. Mm-hmm. So I went through a long journey of working in social advocacy organizations, nonprofits, for-profits, when I realized I was the only woman of color in my teams making these decisions in mm-hmm. a city that's one of the most diverse cities in our country. And so that's how I started KC3. Mm-hmm. I really started it, unfortunately, out of trauma mm-hmm. and wanting to make sure that decisions that are being made related to climate justice and specifically related to clean energy mm-hmm. are being done by people that had the lived experiences in these buildings mm-hmm. that can really determine, yes, that makes sense or no, that doesn't make sense. So mm-hmm. we've been around for 7 years now. So it's been really awesome. I had the privilege to work with community and bring community on board into the team, and we're able to make some pretty, pretty cool and radical change.
Super cool. Can you define for people who don't know the term energy justice?
Sure. So Dr. Shalanda Baker actually has a really good definition of looking at energy justice in a way that supports communities to transition off fossil fuels, but being mindful of historical disinvestment and historical harm. Mm-hmm. And so what we've seen time and time again, if you look at public housing, if you look at a Section 8 mm-hmm. housing, a lot of these buildings have been intentionally disinvested due to structural racist policies like mm-hmm. redlining and other nonsense. And so while we're talking about a clean energy transition, people are just thinking about, let's slap on some solar panels and heat pumps and call it a day. Mm-hmm. But they're not addressing the mold, the lead, the asbestos, the housing crisis. Mm. People can't afford to live where they're at. And so just slapping on renewables into a building is not going to fix the current situation that a lot of households are in. Mm. So for us, when we talk about energy justice, we're fundamentally thinking about, how do you comprehensively address the building systems from a people perspective, mm. ensuring that their rents aren't going to be raised because we're electrifying everything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I love that breakdown. And, you know, when it comes to energy justice, from my perspective, it's like, people don't realize that a lot of Americans and people here in the US like don't have yeah. energy security.
Yeah.
People are realizing that their energy bills are going up
yeah.
and they're like trapped in the system, and yet they don't have access to what should be like a fundamental human right, which is yes. access to electricity.
Access to electricity and access to housing should be a fundamental human right. Mm-hmm. A lot of times when we talk about electrification, people are thinking about, well, you know, bills are going to go up and mm. people are already energy burdened. About 25% of New Yorkers are energy burdened, being Black and Browns being the ones that are mm. worse off. Surprise, surprise. I'm not surprised, but people apparently are. Mm-hmm. And one of the fundamental issues is that people are so focused on like, okay, how do we figure out this energy burden? But people are energy insecure. Mm-hmm. So Dr. Diana Hernandez from Columbia University, she has done researches for decades on energy security. People can't even afford to pay their energy bill. Mm. They're determining if they want to pay their food bill, their housing costs, or their energy bill. And sometimes you can see statistically that folks will rather die in the heat than go and pay for this energy bill because they can't afford it. Mm-hmm. So it's a real important nexus of, how do we ensure people are being transitioned off mm-hmm. without sacrificing more of what they don't have?
You know, you were saying that a lot of your journey was built out of trauma and anger towards such a broken system. Like, what were the steps that you took to like start developing like knowledge and understanding to build expertise in this space?
There was a couple of things that I did. The first one was just like, there's so much access to information. I would say they're behind weird walls. So there are a lot of webinars. There are a lot of reports that are out there that a lot of the leading kind of climate agencies or energy agencies are publishing. Those reports are not accessible in a sense that they are fairly technical. Mm-hmm. And so once you do have access to those reports that are publicly available, one of the things that I always do is I ran to my engineers. I am a recovering engineer. I did not do well in engineering school. And so I know a lot of other engineers and a lot of other policy folks that are love what they do. And I'll go with the report. I'm like, hey, I need you to explain this in kind of common English mm-hmm. Until I got the understanding and became sort of a technical translator myself. So that was kind of the primary thing. Mm-hmm. The secondary thing is that there are a lot of resources outside of the energy sector that helps you understand how to navigate different systems. So how do you navigate opening a business? How do you navigate developing relationships? Mm-hmm. And being in an urban city, I'm grateful that there are agencies that provide those technical services mm. at low or no cost to minority folks and low-income folks, because that way we're able to get that opportunity to kind of navigate that space. Mm. Those are kind of two things that were incredibly helpful to help me kind of further anchor my knowledge base. Mm. I often tell folks, like, as someone that survived Hurricane Sandy, mm-hmm. I was angry because I was studying sustainability and learning about it. But at that moment, Like when my parents and I were on our roof, I couldn't do anything. I was just like, we're going to die here. And it wasn't until I took a couple of seconds back and kind of reassess and say, wait, what is going on? Like, why did this happen to us? How do we go from public housing to my parents being the first people in multiple generations to purchase a house? Mm-hmm. And then we're about to die. It's because the only area my parents could afford was an area that was previously redlined. Mm. And so there's generations of structural racist policies that come into play to that. Mm. And if it wasn't for, you know, conversations that I had with different folks and kind of mapping everything together, that I realized like racism, structural racism policies really have a deep seated effect in what's happening today. Mm-hmm. Which is insane. Because people like to wash it off and be like, no, it's not real. Like, it's not what's happening. It's just, you know, it's just unfortunate. It's like, no, this is generations and generations of intentional folks leaving people behind. Mm. And we're seeing the consequences today.
No, I'm really glad you brought up Hurricane Sandy, because I think sometimes people, you know that that happened and it woke them up to the need for more climate resilient neighborhoods, or like being able to prepare your community for future natural disasters. But yet, like, you know, there's still all these structural inequalities, right? So it's like, it's easy to say, okay, we want to build a more climate resilient city. But then if you're not addressing a housing crisis or an economic crisis, or like we're talking about energy insecurity, you're not necessarily getting at the root of the problem that like made a lot of these communities vulnerable in the first place, right?
Exactly. And it's multi-layered. I think a lot of folks, exactly, you mentioned there's a housing crisis, there's an energy insecurity crisis, energy burden. There's also this component of folks saying, we want to move communities forward. And the way we can move communities forward is by getting them trade jobs. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, do you hear how you sound? Yes, that's good. Mm-hmm. But we're more than just our physical labor. Mm-hmm. Like, why do we always say Black and brown folks, physical labor, great, check. It's like, no, there's multiple things that people can contribute in the community besides our physical bodies for labor. It's so problematic.
Oh my God. That's facts, honestly. Like, I'm going to check myself. Like, you know, even with the passage of things like the Inflation Reduction Act, which I think are amazing strides for our communities. Yeah, it's interesting because people are saying like, oh, like we assume Black and brown folks are the ones that are not going to have college degrees. So yes, they're the ones that get the trade jobs. And true, in a way, I've kind of fallen into that rhetoric too, if I'm being honest, because that's kind of what's being sold and marketed these days. So,
absolutely. No, it's the easiest pathway, right? Like the IRA pass, which is great,
right?
But how do we use these funds to exist to support the status quo of energy programming? The status quo of energy programming is not designed by people with lived experiences.
Whoa.
And so we're supporting electrification, but how are we doing that? Mm. Right? Are we going to put on solar panels in a 100-year-old roof?
Right.
It's excessive. No roof is 100 years old. But you know, the point is that we have to think more critically about what are the decisions being made and how community are given the power to make those decisions for themselves.
And you know, what I think is really incredible about your work is that you also are really focused on cross-sector collaboration. Like, you've had your hand in a lot of different buckets. You've been in a lot of different rooms, from like NYSERDA to, you know, just all sorts of things. I want to talk a little bit more about the importance of that, right? With like your business, like what has been the role of like working with so many different entities and players? Like how have you like navigated kind of translating to be in so many different rooms, and how has that like benefited your business?
Yeah, I think one thing we joke around internally is we call ourselves energy social workers. So like, we work with our community who are cases, and we listen to the spectrum of things that they're having issues with. And so that gives us the privilege of saying, hey, NYSERDA, hey, utilities, hey, federal government, here's the reality of what's happening within communities. Mm-hmm. And these are the different steps that you need to take in order to make this right. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be scalable, right? Because every community is unique. And that's part of the issue that exists, is we want to do this transition as quickly as possible. And if we're doing it as quickly as possible, we're sacrificing some few for the many. Mm-hmm. But what's been very valuable is we've had that opportunity to speak up and raise those concerns. There's a nonprofit that we work really closely with called NHS of Queens, and they're in Woodside, Queens. And they had come to us and saying, hey, there's some predatory vendors that are coming and saying, do solar at no charge. Mm. And we have someone that's going to foreclose their home because the solar contractor gave them a predatory loan. Mm. It was, I had no idea this was happening. And we raised this up to NYSERDA, where there's like, hey, this is not okay.
Wow.
We need to make sure that folks that are involved on the ground that are providing for foreclosure prevention and first-time homeowner programs are more deeply embedded with the energy sector and what's happening so that community members can make an educated decision on how they're engaging renewable companies. And from that, we were able to seek funding and support that organization to upskill their staff learn about solar and to learn about roof repairs and kind of how do you assess it on their own.
Wow.
And so for us, it's so important to like ensure that the existing ecosystem that lives in community that's been around since before I was alive, that's been supporting community, can have those tools and that information to ensure that people aren't being extracted on or predicated on. And it's very, very important as we continue this transition to make sure that the existing ecosystem is is being uplifted and connected directly to the sector. So that's kind of how KC3 plays that role. We kind of we hear from the community what's happening, we connect it to the energy sector, and then we step away because we're not there to kind of continuously bridge it. We want them to build that bridge together.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, the experts themselves live in these communities.
Exactly.
And it's about being able, you know, when we talk about adaptation and being able to make sure that it's location specific, we have to make sure that we're actually tapping into the expertise of the people that live there, right? And I think that that's the interesting thing, like with the whole clean energy or renewable energy transition, it's like, oh, we just need thousands or millions of solar panels and like that's going to solve the problem. But it's like, but this is actually like in places where real people live and there's actual real life consequences of that, right? I'm wondering, like, you know, what has been, I mean, I love the story you just shared, but are there other stories of like success stories where like equity was really at the center? You're really empowering community leaders and you saw like what a difference that made rather than, you know, some outside agency or entity coming in to impose a project. I'm just wondering, like, if you have any other stories on that.
Yeah. I mean, I think the way I intentionally designed KC3 were kind of two components to it. One was the component of respecting and supporting the existing ecosystem in our community to participate in the clean energy transition and lead and spearhead that initiative. And the other one is to literally have community members and people with lived experience to participate in that decision-making, a part of KC3.
Oh, cool.
So most of the folks at KC3 are actually not engineers.
Wow.
They're folks that have social work background, psychology background, education background. That's they really were cool. teachers. They used to work in swamplands, kind of checking on fishes. And so our role was to say, okay, we acknowledge, similar to myself, right? I come from low-income household. There are other folks in the community that wanted to participate more than physical labor. And so what we've done is we've done a comprehensive training structure internally at KC3, where we provide our staff not only with training on the engineering and how to deal with imposter syndrome.
Wow.
Because we deal in a predominantly white space and most of my team are women and women of color that have to not only speak up about policies, but speak up in a space that doesn't want them to be there. And so that's very important to me to ensure that not only are we supporting community and our nonprofit partners externally, but that the people we have internally, we're building them up and we're building up that confidence so that they can do the decisions that they need to do. And they're killing it. I mean, they're doing great.
That's so cool.
And they really understand the dynamics and the intersectionality of being from the community and also mobilizing that change in a way that's respectful to the existing ecosystem.
That's so cool. Like you like built that into the structure.
Yeah.
That's really incredible.
It was like a priority for me because I knew working in the private sector, which was a very short stint, that I, being the only woman, the only Latina in their team, providing advice on what to do in affordable housing was so bizarre to me. And the point that people would just shut down my ideas because they didn't align to like revenue ideologies or whatever nonsense would come out of their mouths. I had to take a step back and say, wait, why is it not important to them? It's not important to them because they have no idea what it is. Mm. And quite frankly, they don't care. Mm. And so for me, I want to make sure that as community members are being uplifted and working with us as partners or as employees, that they don't have to have that self-doubt. And I always tell my team, like, you guys are way smarter than a lot of the people we work with. Trust me.
Wow.
Because the industry is constantly changing. Technology comes and goes, but people are always here. Mm-hmm. And so I always help them understand. And with my team, you know, I couldn't do it without Sierra, who's from Cagebird HR, and Patty, who's from Lai Consulting. They're my HR and leadership coach. They together are supporting folks to say, like, you know your stuff. Don't let this person doubt you, because at the end of the day, they're just following the trends, and you'll continue to support the folks that you know best.
I love that so much. I mean, you've been such a huge supporter of, like, Green Jobs Board and, like, what I've been building. And, like, I'm at, like, the beginning of my journey of being, you know, a founder of, you know, like a climate tech company. And, like, you know, we're at, like, the very beginning of, you know, wanting to scale a company that, like, is built around, you know, community oriented principles. And I keep hitting, like, you know, these walls, you know, due to the industry, where it's like, oh, but, like, how are you going to scale? Who are your advisors? Like, how do you incorporate that leadership? And so it's just really inspiring to hear that, like, you've been able to, like, build such a successful, like, entity while also, like, weaving in community partners. And, like, I'm just wondering, like, how do you manage it all? Like, what are the tools or the resources that helped you? Like, do you have coaches for yourself? Like, how did you like know how to structure that or figure that out?
I had no idea. I mean, I had no idea. Okay. I come from civil servants family who wanted the best for me. Like, my parents, I love them to death. They were just like, go to school and do good and you'll be great. And I remember when I had the conversation with them that I was going to leave the firm that I was in and start my own, they were like, but Daphne, you're at a consulting firm. You're living the dream. Like, it's not my dream. The American dream is not designed for us. Like, if you're black and brown, this is not for you. And it was a very tough conversation to have with them, but they supported it. First of all, people always came up to me with the concept of growth. They're like, your company can go nationwide. Your model is so unique. If I do that, I'm completely abandoning my mission, my values. Mm. For me, again, what I always think about is my parents and I almost died. My grandfather died of asthma living in a factory neighborhood. My brother passed away in public housing. Mm. All of these people passed away in housing and because of environmental effects. And yes, this is happening across the country, but it is up to community to figure out and move forward what opportunities exist best for them. And so when people come to me and they're like, well, why don't you scale your company? Why don't you do this? I'm like, success to you looks like scaling. Success to me means something completely different, which is deeper engagement, deeper relationships, deeper support of the ecosystem. So that's kind of one thing that's really hard, because people are constantly like, oh, but you should do this. People have so many
opinions.
It's just so ridiculous.
Trust me.
But, yeah. Well, one thing my mother told me is, like, if they don't pay your bills, don't listen to them.
And okay. I like that.
You're absolutely right. I love that. It doesn't mean anything. I knew things that I hated. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, I want to correct these. Some things I overcorrected for and I had to realign myself. Mm-hmm. And then other things, it was intentionally built in. So, like, I wanted to pay fully my health insurance. I wanted to have a 401k that was fossil free. Mm-hmm. I wanted to make sure that my staff's internet was paid for. It's little things that I remember being annoyed at other places that I was like, okay, I'm going to build this in now. How much will this cost? Mm-hmm. And New York City has a small business service program, which is specifically designed for people that live in public housing, people that are low income, people that want to start a business. And they have a whole bunch of, like, free mentorships, and they go through classes. Wow. And so I did exactly that.
That's so
I was
cool.
Like, okay, I don't even know how to open a business. Like, I was on YouTube being like, WWW, how do you open a business? And then I learned about B Corps, and I was like, oh wait, I actually want to start a B Corp.
That's so cool.
And I want to start it in New York because I want my taxes to stay in New York. It's like, we pay more taxes than these large companies that I don't even bother naming. And so it was a lot of, like, learning trial by error and talking to folks that were around me. Like, I had no shame. I would reach out to folks and be like, hey, I saw you've done this program. You don't know me, but what were your thoughts?
Okay.
And sometimes they'll ignore you and it's fine. Sometimes I've had people tell me to go fuck off and I'm like, okay. But it doesn't bother me. I guess they don't pay my bills.
They don't pay my bills. I like that. So it was a lot of just, yeah, I mean, this is really encouraging because that's kind of been my process. It's just been a lot of like asking a lot of people a lot of questions.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I love that, you know, you tackle imposter syndrome at the root of it because I think there's so much of that, especially when you're navigating just a predominantly white space and industry. Yeah. How did you just like assert yourself in those spaces, like in this industry? How do you continue? Because I love what you were saying that like the community members doubt their own expertise and you're telling them, no, you are
you know,
on their level.
You know more than these people with PhDs, trust me.
Exactly. So like, I'm just, yeah, like when you're going into these rooms, like, you know, what is your mindset? Like, how are you thinking about it?
To be completely honest with you, the way I think about it is if whatever I say, I have nothing to lose because I live here. And if I get kicked out of the sector, I'm going to still go back to the same building that I live in, still see the same people that I see, and I'll feel good about knowing I tried. And so I walk into that space constantly thinking about everyone here, especially folks that don't have lived experience. They're here because they're passionate about whales or trees or trying to solve climate, like, which is nice. It's important. Shout out to y'all that do that. I respect it. But people are dying, and nothing that I can say will change the fact that people are dying for the bad, right? Like, not more people are not gonna die. So I go into that space knowing that I have my lived experiences backing me up and my technical expertise as an engineer, as a recovering engineer. And no matter what people can say, like, I understand what it means to go back home and see my grandmother struggling because there's still factories in the neighborhood, or seeing my family being priced out because of gentrification and because of this investment in like remobilizing buildings in a way that makes sense for the climate, but not sense for people. And so to me, I kind of give no fucks what people have to say because it's, the reality is that they'll go back and they'll enjoy their summers and their winters. And I go back and I see the shit that we're dealing with because of the policies that we implement. And there, and I want to make sure that for me, at the end of the day, the policy and the practice has to be connected. Because if it's not connected, then what are we doing?
That's facts. So, you know, you're saying, you know, the technology's evolving. Policy obviously moves a lot slower than that. But what are the opportunities? What are the levers that could be pulled or that you're saying could be pushed forward more to build more energy security, especially in communities of color?
Yeah, I think there's a interconnection between policy and organizing. A lot of good organizers out there are really pushing for some strong policies related to tenant protections or related to ensuring that people aren't getting evicted for no reason. Housing Justice is one of the biggest organizations really fighting that. REACT and UPROSE are also talking about, you know, how do we eliminate fossil fuels from properties? So I do think that there needs to be a prioritization and investment on like policy that is sane for low income and communities of color and immigrant communities as well. Because if we go into the immigrant communities piece, that's completely a whole nother thing that our sector hasn't even doesn't even want to touch.
Right.
Like, they'll consider communities that have mixed status families a high income family because it's unreported, because they just use census data. Like, that's how problematic the energy sector is.
Oh, geez. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, all of Queens, if you look at, you know, some of the DAC maps, like, Queens is considered, Jackson Heights, Queens, and Corona, Queens, it's all considered middle income. Like, have you ever even stepped into the neighborhoods? Like, it's super diverse. There's mixed income, mixed status families, and they cannot qualify for these programs.
Wow.
And so for me, when I think about how do we kind of move forward, it's really prioritizing those policies and the environmental justice organizations, housing justice organizations that are pushing for right things. I think we need to, yes, we need to solve climate today, but we need to, if we prioritize low-income communities, the rest will follow. We don't have to incentivize market rate. Market rate has the resources to move in whatever way they want to move. And they do. We need to really focus on folks that have been historically disinvested in and make sure that we're not having them start from 100, like meet them where they're at and provide them with the resources that they need, which means straight up just free money to get them to where they need to be, which is not a conversation people like to have.
It's not because it's like, you're like, it goes back to like, oh, providing community resources.
Yes.
And then that's viewed as social services, which has its own set of like politicization.
Exactly. But we can fund other things. So we can fund other things. We can definitely fund this.
Right. Because it's like, yeah, and it goes back to this whole thing. Like, if you care about quote unquote climate resilience, don't just do it for like the wealthy communities that are going to be fine regardless.
Yes.
And that's kind of the story where they kept saying like, oh, we're just going to build a giant seawall around New York City. And it's like, okay. But then it's like, what are we doing in the meantime to like get people prepared to like learn what to do in those situations? And
yeah,
I just think there's a huge lack of funding in just education and basic even like disaster preparedness, or even like understanding what options you have during a heat wave. Like, these are like things that we can do today instead of like, I understand building a seawall, but it's like,
it's also like, we can potentially put in climate awareness, climate mitigation, climate adaptation into K-12 education. Why are we not doing that?
Right.
Like, there's little things that are not going to cost you anything.
Right. Rather than like it's a multi-million-dollar seawall.
It's just little tweaks that can happen, but it just breaks people's heads.
Yeah, it's insane. Yeah. On that note, like, how do you feel policymakers could be doing a better job at ensuring that there's like equity at the center and that they're like pushing for these things?
I think the policy needs to come from a human perspective, right? And so I think a lot of times when policies are being designed, it's being designed from greenhouse gas emission perspective, which is important, but they need to think about what are the unforeseen consequences, right? Mm-hmm. So we want to make sure that, you know, a good amount of New York State has solar. What does it mean to actually incorporate solar in a diverse typologies with diverse financial situations? Mm. What are the financial products? Maybe the policy should be focused on like, well, in LMI communities, they're able to receive free solar or in commercial spaces, large commercial spaces that are, you know, publicly owned, then they can do power purchasing agreements, right? Mm. If you're having power purchasing agreements in lower income communities, what does it look like to have consumer protections and a consumer bill of rights, which doesn't exist? Mm. And so these are kind of little tweaks that just needs to happen, ensuring that communities are not being left for shit as we're doing these clean energy transitions. And that's so important for policymakers to really think about it holistically. You know, as we go into Local Law 97 compliance this year, there's a lot of quite kind of contradictory to the press, a lot of affordable housing, supportive housing, low-income co-ops, they want to do this work. Mm. And we spend a lot of time sitting with those low-income co-ops. A lot of them are HDFCs, Housing Development Finance Corporations. Another nonprofit called UHAB really works closely with them. And we spend months helping them kind of navigate the space of like talking to local contractors, trying to acquire financing. But the system isn't there for them. Mm. We've talked to literally over 12 banks for one 8-unit building co-op that was really interested in electrifying. They want to put heat pumps everywhere and they want to do new insulation, new roof. But all these single banks reject them because they're not achieving the debt to income ratio that they want. They're not achieving the particular profitability over the loan. And so we go around and we're like, okay, we have people that want to do this, but no one wants to fund them. Why? Because they don't have money. Why? Because they have been historically disinvested in for generations. So we're going around in a circle here.
Wow.
And what we were able to do was we Frankenstein money, right? We took money from utilities. We took money from the state. We asked city council. We're doing a whole bunch of things to put together this Frankenstein opportunity, which we do for every building we work with.
Wow.
But that's not a solution. This is a clear policy failure,
right?
That we have to do this. And so as we're talking about how do we support these buildings moving forward and these community members, whether they're homeowners or low-income co-ops, we have to make sure that whatever products, whether it's through the Greenhouse Reduction Fund, whether through IRA, whether through NYSERDA, whether through whatever, it's being mindful of those that will get automatically rejected of the status quo.
Jeez. Wow. It's like when you realize, like, you're like, you want these solutions, but people don't want to put money behind it. It's like, it's nice to say in like a nice speech, but then it's like in practice, it's like, you're not going to actually put the money there because it's like, oh, well, not to those people.
Yeah, exactly.
To those people. Exactly. It's like, well, then what are you doing?
And then you have people who are very confidently saying in closed door, it's fine. You know, unfortunately, the tenants are going to have to pay for it. I'm like, so let me get this straight. We need to electrify today and we're going to put heat pumps everywhere and people are in a pandemic dealing with inflation, dealing with a housing crisis and oops, they're going to have to pay for this too. Like, do you hear yourselves? Do you hear what you're saying? Our minimum wage is now $16 an hour. The average rent in New York City is $3,000 a month. How the heck? Like, that math isn't math.
Yeah, no. The math is not math, man. No, it's true. And it's like, and then you're expecting people to like, yeah, add on all these other things. And it's like, no, we should be making those things easier for people. We should be making people's lives better.
Yes. And then you wonder why people are so furious every election. It's like,
right.
You're making people's lives literally impossible.
And the subway fares went up too.
Yeah, exactly. It's crazy.
Don't forget the subway fares. I'm like, it's impossible to even like breathe without paying money these days. You leave really the house and then you're like dying. Positive note of just like, you know, what I love that you're doing at KC3 is like building a blueprint. Like you said, people are trying to tell you to do this nationwide. Of course, for your very reasonable reasons, you know, you're keeping it in your own community. But, you know, I have people who listen to this show from around the world and, you know, across the United States who maybe like want to learn how to like build a blueprint to address energy insecurity in like their own areas. And I know that, you know, keeping it general might be difficult, but, you know, do you have any tips on how they can start approaching energy insecurity in their areas if they're seeing that they live in an energy insecure building or community? Do you have any suggestions for them?
Yeah, I think one thing that the industry responds really well with is data. And so you might know living in an energy insecure building or in an energy insecure home as a renter or as a roommate that something's off. Like your bills are way too high. If, to begin with, if your energy burden, you're paying more than 30% of your income on your bill. If that is happening, that's your first red flag. Definitely look at what data is available outside externally with the caveat that traditionally data is not looking at low income and communities of color.
Right.
Ironically.
That part.
But if you start looking at it and you start doing your own surveys and writing up your own reports, like that is gold that you can go to funders, that you can go to government utilities and be like, hey, this is incorrect. Like what? And come up with your own ideas or come up or, you know, leverage other people's ideas and connect with them and collaborate with community members or community organizations and tell them like, this is what my data shows. How do we tackle this? And I'm telling you right now, it's the perfect opportunity to do that. There's a whole bunch of resources out there. Like I mentioned, there's a lot of professors that have studied this. You have Dr. Tony Reams, Dr. Diana Hernandez, Shalonda Baker. And they're more than happy to talk to folks. It's hard in the sense that it's hard to figure out where to start, but you should start with what you know and then grow from there. And I can guarantee you that you'll probably do pretty well considering that this is a space that is one of those like, oh my God, yes, it's very important, but nobody actually does the work for it.
Right. And what do you feel is at stake? Like if we don't address energy insecurity in communities, like what is the impacts on, you know, health, economy, like what are your views on it?
It's going to be completely devastating. I mean, it is devastating. We're seeing every single year more and more communities of color are dying because of climate disasters. And they're probably even being miscategorized because of it too, because there's not enough research. And so really what's at stake is I tell folks all the time, like a clean energy transition is important, but we're not trying to repeat the same mistake that we're currently in. And we're starting to see that. And it makes me really angry. And so we want to make sure that communities are front and center in these decision makers, because what good is it to convert off of fossil fuels when nobody's living there anymore?
Ooh, yes. I think we have to have solutions that make sense for the world we live in today and the communities that have been there. Because yeah, if you're not suiting those needs, it's like, again, you're literally systemically, again, disenfranchising, pushing out, displacing communities that have already had so many barriers and things put against them in the first place. You are just so inspiring. Like, I think, you know, you took such a deep systemic issue and you've taken it into your own hands and you've found the partners that you needed to find and you've been able to build such a the show's about creative solutions to the climate crisis. I think KC3 is a perfect incubator and example of that being done so, so well. And so I just want to leave on a positive note. Like what gives you the most hope in your work?
It's going to be a common theme is people. I feel so good. You know, there was a moment in corporate sector that I was feeling like, why am I wasting my time kind of fighting the status quo as a Puerto Rican, as a person from the projects? Like there's this ideology of like, you're going to have kids at a very young age. You're going to wind up getting a job that is not going to be worth your time. And that's your status quo. And there was a very dark moment where I was like, what am I doing trying to fight this existing infrastructure? But I had the privilege to connect to a lot of people across the country that are doing this. Carlos Alvarez, Jamal Lewis, Sonal Jessel. Like, these are folks that I, Rebecca Morris, like leaned on when this happened. And they're like, what are you doing? Like what you're saying makes sense. People are now paying attention because you're ringing this bell. I'll rant on social media being like, what the hell is going on? And people would listen, which didn't happen before, right? Because of this ideology of like corporate sector, you should be nice and professional and you shouldn't complain out loud. But no, we definitely need to complain out loud. We need to make sure that people hear us and hear our voices and hear the stupidity that's happening behind closed doors. And so it brings a lot of hope to see people across the country saying the same exact thing, really fighting, and seeing all of you coming in to the sector. And I mean, y'all have been in the sector now for a while now, ensuring that communities and people of all walks of life are paying attention to these issues. So I feel like I'm not going as crazy as I used to. Now I'm just like, I lean into my rants knowing that it's important, and I lean into the people that I have because, yes, you know, we're pushing against 400 years of structural racism, right? Literally destroyed everything, but there are little wins that makes it worth it. And I feel good knowing that at the end of the day, when I go back home, yes, things are still shitty, but I'm making strides in ensuring that my community is participating and leading the charge. And that makes my conscience feel good. So, so I can sleep at night.
Well, I love it. And I think everything that you've been pushing forward is something that you never know. Like one of, I'm sure you've heard it already, like from other community members who maybe didn't even see themselves in this work before, finally finding new opportunities and ways to expand their own expertise. So I think you're actively opening doors and building the blueprint so other people can follow suit. So thank you so much for your work and for coming on the show. And just to wrap it up, we love to share resources. So if there's any website or way people can reach you and stay connected, feel free to share it.
Yeah. So we have finally a relaunched website because when I started the company, I created like a very like 1980s looking site.
Love it.
So now we have a site. It's kc3.nyc. Feel free to look at it. We actually have a lot of our papers that we publish about what does equitable decarbonization look like and how do we actually challenge the status quo. You're also welcome to look me up on LinkedIn. That's kind of where I do most of my rants, which is my name, Daphne Rose Sanchez. So thank you so much for having me.
No, of course. Well, you all heard it here. I hope you gained as many insights as I did about energy insecurity today, the need for energy justice, and the need to put communities at the center of the transition towards a more sustainable future. And for those listening, this was the Brown Girl Green podcast. I'm your host, Christy Drutman, where I interview environmental leaders and advocates about the importance of justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion, as well as creative solutions to the climate crisis. Make sure you like, subscribe to the new Brown Girl Green YouTube channel and the Brown Girl Green podcast Instagram, and stay tuned for the next episode. Thanks, everyone. What?